You've desecrated a classic film. This is worse than Godfather 3.
Whoa. Let's not say things we can't take back.
All right, hey guys, and welcome to the Three Drinks In podcast, episode number 162. In this episode, we are talking about The Godfather Part 3 as part of our Better Late Than Never series. Before we do that, though, I want to remind you that we are available on all streaming services, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. Make sure that you subscribe, tell your friends, and leave a review. Look for us on Twitter and Instagram at Three Drinks In Pod. Also on Facebook, and you can email us at threedrinksinpodcast@gmail.com should you have any questions or concerns. I don't know.
Not concerns.
I'm your host, Vince. Over there is your host, Phil.
Hey.
And we are Three Drinks In of Tea.
This is new, the new intro.
Yeah. Starting it off there after the music.
I don't know what I'm supposed to do with my hands.
I'm just lucky I can talk. I've got a touch of that Wuhan flu going around, so. That's not true. I don't have the coronavirus.
That's good.
Oh, yeah, no, very good. So, but I do have a tickle, so that's what's going on here. All right, so Godfather Part 3.
The Godfather Part 3.
We watched it.
Yeah.
Finally. Oof.
Yeah, well, it's just one of those things that everyone talks about, and it's like a joke. And, you know, you're like, is it really as bad as they say? I mean, the first two were so good.
So good.
I was like, let's just sit down and look at it.
And yeah, it was your idea, and I was like, okay. And I just thought literally right through my head, how bad could it be?
Yeah, that's kind of what I said. Like, well, I can't be as bad as they say. It was as bad as they say. Well, I'm on this kick where I'm trying to read as many classic novels as I can. And then that's why I was like, oh, maybe I should watch like classic movies, which is harder than it sounds because a lot of them are slow and boring and hard to find, you know, unless you go to the library now.
The what?
Yeah. That's the place where you little kids do yoga and old people play bingo there and
the
stuff
breastfeeding
like that.
Classes are there.
Yeah, pretty much.
Little kids do yoga. Yeah, that's true. That's what goes on there.
Yeah, so I was like, yeah, we should. Everybody kept talking about The Irishman. I was like, why don't we watch The Last Godfather? It's only 3 hours.
Well, I did watch The Irishman too, and so now you have to.
I guess I do.
Yeah. So, well, that'll be one coming down the pike, folks. Stay tuned.
Yeah. Well, this took 2 nights to watch because I kept putting it off.
I know. I got done by Tuesday, and I'm like, dude, let's get on this.
Yeah, and then I started at like 8:30, and there was like no way I was going to watch 3 hours that late because I'm an old man.
Yeah, thank God for the Amazon 48-hour rental.
Yeah. So, what did you think of The Godfather Part 3?
This was a sort of... I've never watched a more unnecessary film in my life. And that's a word we've used a lot lately when it's come to like making movies, because every movie now is a sequel. There's very... like, rarely do you get like one brand new, like... unique story kind of a thing, which everyone like kind of, you know, that's like the ultimate complaint. So unnecessary really is the word of the decade, I would say. It's like we're in the sequel business, and they've gotten good at it. So it's just such that they don't call it part one and part two, or they don't even label them anymore. If they do, it's kind of clever, like Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. But, you know, they've gotten good in the sense that, like, they weave them all together. So it doesn't feel so much like a sequel, but like a continuation of a larger thing. And This was one of the first series to do big sequels, right? I think The Godfather was, I think they were the first one to use the terms like part two when the second film came out. I heard that somewhere. I'm not sure if it's true or not.
Yeah, they were one of the first to do that.
And I remember when whoever it was directed Empire Strikes Back was talking about it.
Irving Kershner?
Irving Kershner, thank you. Like he didn't want to do it, and he was offered the job, and he was like, you know, you're never gonna make one better than the first one. That was the wisdom in Hollywood at the time, was that like you don't make sequels because they don't do as well. They're just cash grabs. And so I think The Godfather avoided that. In that like parts, like I can't really. I read the book years ago. Were parts of Godfather Part Two came from the Godfather book, right?
Yeah,
like most of the stuff.
There was too much material, so they cut a lot of it out, and then they were like, "Oh, we can use the rest to make the second one."
Yeah, like the one thing I recall from the books was that Lucy Mancini, who is the woman that Sonny is having sex with in the. Like the bridesmaid that he's banging in the upstairs room during the wedding in the opening scene of the first movie, she has a huge role in the second in the book rather. But I think most of the stuff from the book that was in the second film had a lot to do with like just Vito Andolini's backstory, right? That was
his backstory, and a lot of it was them moving to Vegas. Like the move
okay, so
to
that
Vegas
was in there. All right, yeah.
Yeah, it was more involved. Like in the film, they just sort of go and they're just in Vegas.
Yeah.
You know, like selling the house in New York took about 10 seconds. So.
Yeah. Anyway, so like there's a lot of material to draw from for the second movie. This was totally untethered from anything.
Yeah, Puzo wrote it much, much later.
Yeah.
According to Wikipedia, he intended it to be an epilogue. Also, he needed more money.
I love that. He intended it to be an epilogue. All right, yeah. Usually the third thing in a trilogy is an epilogue. So, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you've ever read a book before, but epilogues tend to be short. They're like half a chapter or just a couple of pages. Like, oh, by the way, this character ended up getting, you know, freed from prison or this, like, whatever. Like,
right. It's not an entire 3-hour thing.
No. So it's an unnecessary film. I don't really know what was going on a lot of the time. And everyone in it is terrible. Except for Al Pacino, but he's really not very good either.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, it's an extremely bad movie.
What's the point where Al Pacino started, where his voice changed?
I was looking that up while I was trying to get through this movie, and it wasn't, like, this might have been it.
Yeah,
you know, like I'm pulling up the filmography now. He's only made 61 movies, which is
relatively
small. This is not in a fashion that I can read, so that's not helpful at all. But there was, you keep talking while I after this. I'm like, I should have had this ready to go, and I did not.
You did wait, Marty. I just think it's odd because at some point he stopped sounding like a normal human and he had this gravelly voice and the eccentric, you know, outgoing way of acting.
Yeah.
And he tries to tamp it down here, but there are still some parts where like his entire demeanor has changed. It's like something happened to him.
Yeah. But that's the problem. They changed IMDb. Okay. Yeah, now it doesn't list things like in a line. It has them in two columns, which is stupid.
Oh, us poor schlubs, we can't handle change.
All right, so his career takes off. So The Panic in Needle Park is his first big movie. And then you have The Godfather. And then you have Serpico and The Godfather Part 2, which came out in 74 versus The Godfather 72. The movies that happened after this that made any sort of cultural resonance were Dog Day Afternoon, Cruising only because he was an Oscar winner playing a gay cop in 1980, and that was kind of a thing. So Dog Day Afternoon, Cruising a little bit, Scarface of course, and then this is his career after Scarface. Three movies you've never heard of: Dick Tracy, and then The Godfather Part 3. So Scarface, his performance is pretty memorable, but it wasn't like this. He was playing a ridiculously over-the-top character, but the accent sort of takes over that role. I've never seen Scarface. I actually have no desire to see Scarface. I like Brian De Palma, but not that much. And like he looks like he's just chewing the scenery, and every like 16-year-old kid got a kick out of watching him fire a grenade launcher into the door, of his giant mommy mansion. That's just okay, fine. It's kind of like just action porn. But The Godfather, Part 3, yeah, you could see him sort of like, he of course handed up in Dick Tracy. He hams it up a little bit here, but you can see the restraint. He does Glengarry Glen Ross, and then I think he lets it all go with Scent of a Woman.
Yeah.
Which is the only film for which he's ever won an Oscar.
There's The Godfather Al Pacino, and there's Scent of a Woman Al Pacino.
Yeah, and you can kind of see a slow progression to that point. And here's the thing. He is the only time he's ever won an Oscar was for Scent of a Woman. I forgot. It wasn't. It was De Niro won for Godfather 2, not Pacino. He was nominated, but he didn't win. So, when your highest accolade comes from a film for which you were literally chewing the scenery, you're going to do that over and over again until you die. Because it was fun. It looked like he was having more fun than anybody on Earth. And it made him money and gave him a lot of, not fame, but accolades.
Yeah, well, so I mean, in this one, he's like in between that. So it just feels like a completely different person.
Yeah, there's wisps of it here and there, but like he also looks so different. I mean, between 1973, and 1990, there were, it's 30 years practically.
Sure.
Like he looks different. His haircut was terrible.
And they said like that this movie was made because either Coppola or Puzo had really bad flops and they needed more money, and they were like, make another Godfather, we'll pay you whatever you want. So they did.
Yeah.
And that's why they were like, we couldn't think of any good stories, and most people didn't want to do it, and we couldn't pay Robert Duvall. So they just churned this out.
There was no amount of money you could have given Robert Duvall, I don't think, to do this movie.
Well, he said he wanted a little bit less than Pacino.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't understand why Pacino was getting so much more and he was getting so much less. He's like, I was in the other two. I'm part of this thing. Like, I mean, he was not a small character and they wouldn't pay him. So he was like, all right, well, then whatever.
Yeah. No.
And I think the movie really could have used him.
Well, you want to... I'm like, well, yeah, all right. That's true.
I mean, Robert Duvall. I mean,
The length and breadth of what this film could have used.
Yeah.
Jesus Christmas. All right, so let's go down the list. right off the bat, Sofia Coppola is famously terrible in this movie.
I had no idea how terrible she was.
I'd seen a couple of scenes with her, and I'm like, I think I tried to watch this years ago, and I was like, all right, yeah, no, she's pretty wooden. This is not that good. And then I would get the face you just made.
Wooden? I actually sat up and started paying attention when she opened her mouth. Because I was like, what happened to my TV? Like, I'm like hitting the button, like something's wrong. And then I realized, like, oh my God, that's her acting. And that's like that's the best take of that, apparently.
Did you not have time for a second one?
I was thinking of that Simpsons when, like, Mr. Burns makes his own movie and he plays himself and he, like, is on the horse in some Mexican village. And when he hits the horse, he, like, falls off and gets dragged by the horse past the camera, like, 50 times. And he looks at Smithers. He goes, we did 37 takes and that was the best one. It's just like that. You're like, oh.
Yeah, so the story goes basically that Winona Ryder was supposed to play Mary Corleone. And Winona Ryder, I think wisely, backed out of the project to go play whatever it was she played in Edward Scissorhands, which I've not seen. But made everyone in that movie pretty famous. So, you know, that might have been a good move. Another actress was slated to play the part as well, or at least auditioned for it. And this was just like in the trivia in IMDb, was that she was like a small-time actress and a model, but she was murdered. Like the day she was supposed to go read for the part by a stalker. That had been bothering her for some time. So, yeah, no. But they ended up just kind of, you know, grabbing Sophia and saying, here, you can do it, right? And so there's been some controversy over how much nepotism was involved with this. I think a fair amount.
Fair amount. I mean, you'd have to know she's so terrible.
You would think that somebody at Paramount would have been like, okay, Francis, she's really quite bad. But maybe they didn't know. Nobody had the balls to do it. Maybe everyone in this stood to make a lot of money, and so they figured, it's relatively minor part compared to Michael, and you know, it's, of course, she's the entire emotional core of the film. But
I mean, clearly nobody had the guts to say anything because she's acting next to Al Pacino.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like she's in like the extras scene, like as a running away from a gunfight, like citizen on the street part. I mean, she has a big part and it's just so horrible that you're like, there's no way nobody noticed this.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they found her in a diner, like, hey, you want to be in the movie stall? And they just like threw her up there, but she can't do anything.
Yeah. She ended up having a nice career as a director. But
and that's fine.
It's, you know, that seems to be where the family talent lies.
But you know that these skills are not transferable. Sometimes,
no.
You know, sometimes athletes make terrible coaches.
So yeah. So she's just bad. It's bad. There's no part of it that's good. All of it is bad. You know.
No, even her death was like, that's it.
Yeah, it's like her.
Can you just picture him with the director's, you know, megaphone, like, Sophia, honey, you're dead now. Stop breathing.
And like her reaction to it is so, that his reaction seems ludicrously over the top by comparison.
Yeah.
Because he screams in a way that you normally don't see people scream on film. It just doesn't translate very well.
And you usually don't see men scream like that.
No. And I actually felt that moment was rather powerful because he was so reserved most of the time. But it seemed comical by comparison. Like the whole, Yeah, no, it's so yeah. All right. So we got introduced to a lot of other big time actors through this movie. Andy Garcia, of course, for one. Bridget Fonda had a very small role in the beginning. Of course, Joe Mantegna. They're all good.
They're okay.
I think that Andy Garcia's character was really badly written.
Yeah, they didn't give him... Here's the thing with his character. Okay, here's the thing with the movie. Can anyone tell me what the through line is of this film? Like, when the movie starts, he, like, crashes the party that they're having, makes a fool of everybody because he's got the temper, just like, you know, Sonny, his father, had. And he comes across like this total asshole. And then I thought he was going to be, like, the bad guy or, like, the one you had to worry about. But he isn't. Only sometimes when, like, Michael's trying to train him. And eventually he ends up taking over the entire crime family. You know, so it's like, okay, that's one thing I thought I was supposed to pay attention to. And then you think it's Joe Mantegna's character is the bad guy, and he is for a short time too before he gets murdered. And you're like, so what am I watching? Who's the bad guy? You know, there was just so much story beats that weren't making any sense. One, because they were a little confusing, but also because I wasn't sure what I was supposed to be focusing on. Like, am I supposed to be worried about these Vatican people or Joe Mantegna or Andy Garcia or what?
Yeah, so everything happening in the movie is happening independent of the other things. So there's Michael trying to basically buy himself salvation in heaven, feeling guilty for all the things he's done, including having Fredo killed. There's the business dealings of the Vatican and, you know, how they plan to use the Corleone money to get out of the debt that they're in. There's Michael trying to, in addition to buying himself some salvation, he's trying to purchase a stake in a large international real estate company in order to turn his family's money even more legitimate. However, side note, when they negotiate in that meeting for how much money it's gonna cost him to buy his stake of International Immobiliare, whatever it was, he asks for $600 million. Okay, so this film was made in 1990. It was supposed to take place, though, as the title card said, in 1979. In 1979, $600 million is the equivalent of $2.1 billion today. So I have no problem believing that the Corleone family, like many, you know, crime syndicates, families are very, very wealthy. Fine. $2.1 billion that you have just to buy this thing? I mean, if you're that good of a businessman, which you assume he is, you assume he has another $2 billion just sitting somewhere in a bank account somewhere. It just seemed like a ludicrous amount of money for what they were talking about. So anyway, so there's that. And then there's the whole thing where you have Sonny's bastard kid getting into street fights with Joey Zaza, what's his name?
Joey Zaza.
Zaza. And like that's an entirely unconnected thing, as is the giant hit, you know, that they put on all the crime families at the Atlantic City, you know, penthouse where they, you know, the helicopter comes in and blows them all away, which was the cheapest way you could ever do that scene because they didn't actually show you the fucking helicopter.
Yeah.
And so, like, that was, you know, and it's kind of related because when the old man who ends up being the traitor is also with them in Sicily and is connected. So I guess they're all connected in some way, but it's so unclear.
Yeah, the parts that are not supposed to be as important were overly complex, which is all of the mafia machinations. Whereas like the emotional stuff, you know, this bastard son that you have suddenly wandering around and wants to control everything, and your daughter who falls in love with him, which is super creepy. All of that gets tossed aside.
We'll get back to that, by the way.
You know, and like that's the stuff that they should have spent more time on, not the stuff with the Vatican Bank and the Cardinal and who's supposed to owe who and like what he's doing to get his money more legitimate, but the other mob bosses are bad, and what is Joey Zaza saying around town about him? I was just like, it's either overly complicated or half-baked. And I was like, what? I don't understand what's happening.
I mean, there was
what am I supposed to care about?
There was an entire scene of like, it was a board meeting. And I didn't know where I was, who I was looking at. I knew the character of Michael. I knew his, you know, George Hamilton, his lawyer / accountant. I knew the Cardinal. And that was it. And then it's like a shareholders meeting. And like, what does he want to do? He wants to do something that some people want to do and that others don't. And one random guy in the back of the room yelling about it. But we're not quite sure why. Yeah, it wasn't important. You're right. Like the more important stuff was like, by the way, Dad, are you using me as a front for your... is this foundation a front for this or that? And like, it just, yeah. The hell were they thinking?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, it's the whole point, I guess, was that, you know, right? Like, Michael feels bad that he did all those things and he's trying to make amends. And I don't know why. This is why I think that having Tom Hagen there would have been good, Robert Duvall's character. Because the problem with his character through the other two movies was that he wasn't ruthless enough. He wasn't, quote, Sicilian. He was a member of the family, but he wasn't like them. And so he was always this background character who was like an anchor to his conscience. You know, like he'd always say, like, well, I don't think we should do that, but he'd go along with it. And so not having that character to play off of just makes Al Pacino seem like he's having this change of heart out of nowhere, you know? So he spends a lot of the time bouncing off of Diane Keaton's character, which rings false. And she calls him on it at one point when they're in Sicily. And he's like, oh, spent a lot of time in this room. Oh, I loved it here. She's like, oh, yeah, when you were marrying your other girl before she got blown up. like that's part of it. He never really loved her that much. She was just something else to have, to seem legitimate.
Yeah, and I'm not a huge Diane Keaton fan, but her character never really wavers either. Like, she's like, you know, you're still a monster. I still can't be near you. Like, it's just she never breaks from that, even in their, like when they're driving back and forth to like the town in Sicily, and you know, he's like playing tour guide for the day. You know, it's still, she's so flat about it. Like, no, it's like, I am not going to forgive you for these things. And, which again, doesn't, at least with the Duvall character, you can kind of see the push and pull of that. And that's what sort of makes Duvall such an important actor, is that like he's willing to be, you know, made a eunuch in this, you know, film full of guys with big penises. And like there's this, you know, there's all these little scenes in Godfather Part Two where he's barely effectual, but you can kind of see how he used to be a big deal and now he's not. And like you compare that to Michael, who used to be, you know, like the kid brother of the family, who never really, you know, like they thought that he would have a very separate life, and now they don't seem to recognize each other. And Hagen could look back and see the whole sort of process that Michael's gone through, and Michael himself has essentially become oblivious to it. I mean, it's the great tragedy of his character. And it's sort of simply put that, like, yeah, okay, so, you know, she says, like you said that, you know, you would never be like your father. You said that you would never, be involved in this lifestyle. And she calls him out on it, and he rationalizes it to her over and over again. But as simple as that's presented in dialogue, it's actually rather stark in the sense that, like, he really can't see what's happened to him. You know, he does what all these characters in all of these movies do, is that they just rationalize their behavior, usually using their family as a crutch. Which is why I'm kind of interested to see what you think about The Irishman, because there's a scene at the end of that movie, which is, it's a very small scene, but it kind of hit me like a rock. Like, oh yeah, no, that's, you know, so Scorsese tends to deal with these things in a more real world kind of way. It's a much grittier, less dramatic kind of way. But the thing is, it's always the same thing. They're terrible people who do awful things in the name of, like, of their families and protection and this and that. But really, it's all about themselves and how myopic they are. Walter White's the same thing. He has that great scene at the end of Breaking Bad where Skyler tells him not to say that he did it for the family. And he says, I did it for me. I liked it and I was good at it. You know, you Michael never has that moment where, you know, it all comes crashing down, because he's not allowed it. Instead, he gets this ultra dramatic murder on the steps of an opera house, and he just screams and yells and then falls over dead in a chair at the end of the movie.
Yeah. What makes the whole story a little half baked? I mean, somebody online said, like, I don't really think it feels like fan fiction, because I don't think that this character would feel this way. Would he really be apologizing? Nah, we can spend all day doing that because it's not real. So it's what the guy wrote it. But if you're looking at it in the terms of, like, he wants to be better, he wants to be forgiven, he knows he's done bad things, he doesn't have that moment. Like, if he wants to be forgiven, then he should say, I want to be forgiven. You don't justify it over and over again unless you really don't believe you're forgiven, you know, because you're still deluding yourself. So he goes, like, all the way and then a little bit all the way and back and forth. It's not written well.
No, it's just, it's not.
You know, what's the point of taking the daughter away? Why not the son? Why not all of them? In Citizen Kane, he loses his whole family.
There's nothing particularly special about her. Perhaps because the actress could not convey that?
I think it was supposed to be that, like, because Andy Garcia's character liked her and wanted her around, Al Pacino was like, you can't go out with her because it's dangerous. And so she ends up getting killed, like, the night before she leaves the criminal world, I guess. But that's a bit of a stretch.
And, like, he has the relationship with his son that's kind of weird. And, like that to me was strange, too. Like, he has this fight with, you know, Diane Keaton's character and the son. He wants to be a singer. He's going to, you know, drop out of at a law school. And I'm like, okay, just for a second, can we think about this? You just bought something for $2 billion. Your kids don't have to work. Like, why does he need to be a lawyer? Like, I guess it's important, but you don't want your kids to be sort of shiftless losers. But
I think he wanted them, because when he says, like, I want you to finish law school, oh, Dad, I don't want to be a lawyer. He says, you know, music is important, art is important, but we need lawyers. He goes, I need a lawyer, because I think Robert Duvall's character isn't there, and he wants the business to be, quote, legitimate. And he said, like, if I want my son to work for me, but he won't be a gangster, this is the way to get him in here. Like, but, it's like a manipulating thing.
But isn't being an opera singer also how he could avoid being a gangster?
But he wouldn't be in the family.
I get.
Because in Al Pacino's view, the family won't be a gangster family anymore.
I don't know. It just doesn't click for me. Like,
oh, it's still not good.
It just doesn't. Yeah, like it doesn't make any sense.
I'm just spitballing. It was like a scene they had that they wanted to keep because they had to set up that whole opera scene at the end.
That's pretty much it. Yeah, because like if you want your kid not to be involved in the life, then you get them as far away as possible. It's the entire point of doing all this. You know, that's what is so, you know, ultimately perverse about all of this. So like, I think it was John Quincy Adams, had the, you know, is quoted as saying that, you know, my father was a revolutionary so that I could be a diplomat, and I'm a diplomat so that my son can be an historian, I think is the line. So like, that's what the American dream is that you work hard and then you give your kid something that you didn't have and they take it farther, and it's this sort of this individual familial notion of progress. And you know, the immigrant community in the U.S. in the 20th century, that was their story. It was they all got off of the boat and they had nothing in their pockets and they worked and then they became successful, and some of them, you know, owned delis and then ended up owning, you know, meat companies, and then ended up owning all the meat companies, and some of them became gangsters, but the driving force is still the same. So why is it that when his son says to him, I want to be an opera singer and I'm going to perform in, you know, it doesn't say it's in the scene, but like, I'm good at it, such that I could be so good at singing opera that I could be in law school 1 minute, and then the next minute I'm performing at a world famous opera house in Sicily. I'm that good,
Dad. That doesn't happen to everybody. They do opera in their spare time.
You know, and like, wouldn't he be like, great, that's what I wanted. That was the whole fucking point of all this. Because that's what he wants throughout this movie. You know, what would have been sort of more in keeping with the character is if he didn't want him to do that because he wanted him to remain in the quote-unquote legitimate part, but that's not quite so legitimate, but just don't look in that room over there. And, like, you know, like, if he didn't want to give up the whole thing, if he didn't have all this contrition, you know, it's just not in keeping with what they're talking about. So, yeah. But you're right. It was just also they could do the scene in the most dramatic fashion possible, which is with, you know, people yelling in Italian while singing.
Yeah.
That's all they really wanted to do.
And even that scene wasn't exciting. The movie was so boring.
Oh, God, it was so boring.
Yeah, it was really boring. Like, even the action scenes, all two of them, they weren't very good because they had no emotional weight to them. I didn't care if they shot Joe Mantegna because he's only in it for 20 minutes.
And he's a jerk.
Yeah, you know, nobody likes him. He comes off really slimy. And then what's the other one? The helicopter scene where they shoot all the mobsters? I don't care about that.
You don't care because you don't know who those guys are.
Right, what's their connection? He's just paying them off so he doesn't have to see them anymore.
You know, it isn't like Tessio.
Right.
You know, like that sort of like heartbreaking scene where he just kind of like walks off camera, but it has so much weight because you know he's going to get shot in the head.
Right. Well, you know that there's betrayals there on both sides. And this is a character you've seen throughout the whole film. He's betraying your main character, and your main character is turning around on him and shooting him in the back of the head. So, yeah. But these people, I don't know any of these people.
I mean, in the span of like 10 minutes at the end of The Godfather, they basically tell Tessio, we know it was you and we're going to kill you. And then they go inside, they tell Carlo, we know it was you and we're not going to kill you. And then he gets to the car and he's garroted in the car. In like, that's one of the, like,
yeah,
one of
hello,
those.
Carlo.
It's one of those great scenes that, like, in a litany of great scenes, you kind of forget it happens, but like he fights so hard, he puts his foot through the windshield. You know, like it's just, oh, it's vicious. You know, there's none of that in this. It's just a bunch of guys you don't know. And like there's a joke in the middle of it, too. Did you catch the joke?
Yeah.
The guy's trying to get
my lucky coat.
Yeah, he's trying to get his coat off the wall. And someone goes, "What the hell is wrong with you? It's my lucky coat." And then he gets shot 17 times in the face.
Yeah.
You know. And it looked comical. And you know, so I remember James Caan talking about, you know, getting prepped for the toll booth scene, you know, which is pretty classic. And that was unusual for the time, too, to have that kind of violence. And, like, even the guy who was, like, the effects guy was putting all the squibs on him, which is, like, this little blood pack with a... It's kind of a cool thing. I have to read more about it. It's like a radio transmitter.
Yeah, I know what they are.
Yeah. Well, the audience might not know.
Oh, sorry.
So for those of you who don't know and who aren't so smarmy about it, it's a little like blood pack with a transmitter, and like something makes it go pop, and so you push a button and they all kind of explode on a guy. And I don't know how it works, but it's a, you know, it's like I should, you know, find a YouTube video about it. But like the guy said, I've never put this many scripts on a guy before. Like, I can't believe we're doing this. This is a lot.
Yeah.
You know? And even then, 1970, it looked kind of comical. Like, if you really look at the scene and how they did it, and he's kind of like falling all over the car, but like you don't care because the tension in that scene is palpable. And it seems so over the top. You know, it's like six guys with guns, and then there's this, just him in his car. You know, and this you have supposed to be, I guess, the big version of that, and it carried no emotional weight, it carried no tension. Like, you kind of comes out of nowhere in a way. You don't, like, there's no build up to it. You just kind of, I'm going to go leave the room now. Can't imagine why. And you go, oh, I bet something is going to, oh, look at that. That's very loud.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, you don't see the helicopter. You don't, you know, there's no tension to it. It's just, yeah, it's dull.
So the whole kissing cousins thing.
Was that cool back then? This movie takes place 2 years before I was born. And
yeah, well, I think at that point it's 1980.
Fine. Like, that doesn't make anything any better.
If that helps.
if that helps. Yeah, that... I mean, and they keep referencing, like, They're going out. Oh yeah? Yeah.
Yeah, nobody has any reaction to that.
And but like they constantly, hey, Vincent, your cousin is here. Like this is cool? Back like I don't know. I haven't done any I should have done some research to see what people said about this, but like and they even say she's your first cousin. Or he's your first cousin. They don't even, you know, quibble over, like, which removed they are, like.
Yeah. I don't know. I thought it was odd.
It's extremely strange. I don't see what the purpose of, well, her at all. Like, she serves no function, but for the only function that the children of Michael seemed to serve in the film really is just to get you to the end. The son has to be there to be the opera singer so they can be at an opera house. The daughter has to be there to get killed. They don't do anything else.
Right, well, that's what I mean. Like, their parts are so limited because they share a few scenes with Pacino, and in all of them, they're always happy. But the idea is that they're supposed to be, since she doesn't want to leave the business and leave and like understand what's happening, her being around Andy Garcia's character puts her in danger. And that doesn't come up again until like the end. I mean, there's huge chunks where he's barely in it. Like, he just becomes like the guy who follows Michael around, and he doesn't say anything and he doesn't talk. That's the same thing. He doesn't go anywhere or do anything. You know, so it's like, okay, I thought this was this. I thought he was going to be the bad guy, and then I realized, oh, they're just going to take him in and they'll train him. But all of his training gets like swept away. Like you don't see any of it. So by the end of it, he's like this cool, cold-blooded killer kind of guy. I'm like, when did this happen? He was the hothead a minute ago.
Yeah, and he remains the hothead essentially until they get to Sicily.
Right, until he doesn't have to be anymore.
Because, like, I mean, the movie just kind of goes on and, you know, they escape from the thing in Atlantic City and they get back to the house. And then he has his diabetic attack, which, oh, by the way, he has diabetes. Kind of an important thing because it happens again. And then they're in Sicily, like the next scene. Like they have a couple scenes. So while he's laid up, Vincent goes around and kills Joey, Zaza, and a bunch of other people, and then they just move on.
Yeah, and I think that's what the kid part is for, just to set up this fall for Michael. Like, no matter how hard you try, you can never really get out of it, apparently.
Yeah, no, it's just a bad movie, everybody.
Yeah, and it got mixed to positive reviews when it was released, which is shocking.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm one of the few, but I didn't even really like that second one that much.
Second one is good, but it drags. It doesn't...
And the parts with De Niro were good.
Yeah, like people really like the Godfather saga. My wife likes that one a lot, where they basically take all the footage and they re-edited it so it's in chronological order. And, yeah, people really enjoy that. But, yeah, the parts with De Niro are good. The parts, you know, with... The problem with The Godfather Part 2 is that it's physically all over the place. Like, the first movie, it was a relatively contained story geographically. And in the second one, they're in Nevada. They're in New York for part of it. They're in Washington, D.C., which I never quite knew why he was in Washington, D.C. Like, is that some kind of a historical fact I'm not aware of, where they were dragging mob bosses in front of the cameras to be like, aren't you a mob boss? And he's like, no.
Yeah, they were doing that in the 50s.
Okay, like, fine, but, like... It's
same with this film, with, like, all the Vatican banking scandals and stuff.
Yeah, and by the way, how did he just walk around the Vatican and shoot that guy?
I know. Yeah, they were like, well, if you happen to go to the Vatican, next thing you know, he's in the Vatican.
And not, like, oh, you know, walking past the front door. He's, like, in some kind of a, you know, giant marble stairwell.
Yeah, like he's in like the inner sanctum. I'm like, well, how did he get there? I've been to the Vatican. You know, it's locked up pretty tight.
He's dressed like a mobster from the Batman TV show, you know, with the hat and the whole bit.
Like if they dressed him like a Swiss guard, I'd at least be like, oh, okay, he snuck in.
Goofy.
Maybe you like beat a guy up and put it on.
He just walked in there. I assume he was just standing in the shadows. And they poisoned the Pope because that's easy to do.
Yeah, big on the poison. Poison is the thing you use when you don't want to have to explain how people die.
Right. Oh, we got into his tea.
It's a really...
Somehow.
It's a really cheap storytelling. And I know people use poison a lot, but it's really not dramatic in terms of storytelling. So it's like, oh boy, she poisons him with that cannoli that takes him 4 hours to eat.
And she like takes a little bit.
Yeah.
In like the most like unattractive filmed eating scene I've ever seen in my life.
She like licks it.
That was so gross. The hell were we talking about?
So The Godfather Part 2.
Yeah. So like, yeah, they're in Nevada, they're in New York, they're in DC, they're in Cuba, they're in Florida. And like you're just kind of bouncing around and you're really not quite sure what everyone is doing. Like The Godfather, it's very clear who everybody is and what they want. and how people's characters are changing. But with The Godfather Part II, they're just, like, his goal is simply to make more money, right? That's all he's doing.
Right, and they get caught up in double-crossing one another.
And so, like, I think the big overarching themes that people would say play out is that the films are about corruption. The second one is about the corruption of governments, and the third one is about the corruption of the Catholic Church. I don't know how the first one fits into that, though. Like, two and three are kind of the same in that regard, in that they are dealing with broad ideas about institutions and how it's not just the mafia that is corrupt and, you know, dangerous. That, you know, it's, and it's something that Michael says, you know, in the first one. She says, you know, he says, my father is just like any other powerful person, like a president or senator. And she says, well, senators don't have men killed. And we get that very popular meme now. Well, now who's being naive?
Mm-hmm.
You know. So I guess corruption in the first one appears tangentially, but it's not, I guess, amongst the five families there's corruption, but not really. That's what they're supposed to do. They're crime families.
I think it's the corruption of the actual family.
I mean, like, as a concept.
As a concept. Being in this sort of business corrupts your family and destroys it from the inside.
Yeah, I guess you can make it. It's just so much more interesting that way.
Yeah, well, it just has a better storyline in that you're watching the rise of the good son becoming a terrible person.
Yeah. There's nobody in that second movie that changes.
That's always been my complaint with the second one, where, like, the first one you're watching Michael become a horrible man, willing to murder everybody to protect his family and get everybody out of his own way, including his brother-in-law and, you know, random strangers and what have you. And in the second one, it's the same thing, only now he kills his brother. Which is supposed to be this shocking thing, you know, like, oh, he had his own brother murdered. It's not that shocking. He's had many people murdered. And he's made it quite clear that that's not an obstacle. You have to go really far, but it's something he's willing to do. Yeah. If that's the whole movie, it's like, all right, then fine.
Is it telling then that there's a scene in The Sopranos where Carmela talks about the fact that Tony likes the second one better than the first?
Yeah, because it shows you what the priorities are.
Yeah, like I always think about that movie Cold Pursuit with Liam Neeson. We watched a few months ago. Where
yeah, I like that movie.
Yeah, that was a good movie. But like the evil drug kingpin, his you know, he's talking to his son who doesn't like to, like, who's like being bullied at school, and he's like, didn't I give you Lord of the Flies? All the answers are in there. And like, he's just like, boy, this guy took the wrong message from Lord of the Flies. Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And
that's,
and like, if you prefer Godfather 2 over 1 and you're a gangster, it's because you identify way more with the motivation in 2 than 1. Mm-hmm. When like you like, and like that's ultimately the thing about sequels, is that it has to get bigger. You very rarely can do a sequel where the thing you're watching is sort of smaller. Like, Star Wars gets away with it because, you know, what's bigger than the Death Star? Nothing. Just nothing bigger than that at all. And so you have an emotional bigness happen in that movie, in the sense that you find out that Darth Vader is Luke Skywalker's father. You don't have a big obstacle to overcome in terms of destroying a giant object. But you only get one bite at that. Once you make the third one, you have to make a different Death Star. You know, and you kill the Emperor, but fine. Like it's not really that big of a deal. So, like, even with The Godfather, which two is a great movie, too. It really is. But everything had to get bigger. Because that's just how sequels work. It's just the only way, you know, you can kind of get around that. It's like Marvel's trying to one up that whole concept by doing a reset with the next stage of movies. So you make all these movies and then you get to Endgame and okay, boom, we had a giant battle bigger than anything you can imagine and now it's over. Okay, let's take some time, we'll make some smaller films, then we'll build it, but they're just going to have to do it all over again. So you have the same problem, it's just cyclical. You've found a way to stretch it out over, you know, 25 years worth of making movies. But, you know, even these classics still suffer from the same basic problem, is that once you make a movie and you're going to tell a continuating story, you know, you either have to have something new happening, like with the Vito Corleone stuff from the 19 teens and 20s in the flashbacks. You get to see who people are and how they get there. That's always kind of fun. Because, again, that's somebody changing. You meet him, he's a little boy who can't talk. And by the end, he's the king of New York. So that's why that stuff is better. You know, but otherwise, there's no development. There's just largeness happening.
Yeah.
So
it stinks.
It stinks. Oh, well, God, it was so bad.
At least I'm glad I know how bad it stinks. Like, now I don't feel bad crapping all over it.
No, I can speak with authority. This is a terrible, terrible film.
I sat through it.
Oh, God.
Took me a couple of nights, but I did.
Yeah. Well, that's time. We're not getting back.
No.
No.
No, it's gone now.
All right. So, anything else?
No, I think that's it.
That's everything. All right. Well, if you guys out there have thoughts about Godfather 3 that you want to share with us, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at 3DrinksInPod on both. You can like us on Facebook and email us at 3DrinksInPodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, tell your friends, leave reviews. And that's it.
Yeah. All right.
Okay. We'll talk to you all next time.
Yep. Take care.
Bye. Oh, and I forgot to say, to please drink responsibly.
Oh, yeah, that too.
That's still true. All right. Bye, everybody.
You've thought a lot about Pacino, and you believe that there are different...
I worship Pacino.
You worship Pacino, as I think most actors have to, but there are different... He's changed, and he's had so many different stages, hasn't he?
Stages of Pacino, yeah. When he was young, you have to pitch your voice up very high, which I don't think I can do anymore. But remember that scene in Serpico, mm-hmm. when he takes the kid who's the rapist or whatever, he's the criminal, and he says to him, "You and me are gonna go." He says, "You and me are gonna go for a walk, just the two of us, without cuffs." Can I say a bad word?
Sure.
He goes, "Me, I'm gonna put one." I can barely do it.
Yeah.
He goes, "You and me are gonna take a walk without cuffs. You me, I'm gonna put one in your back." And he does it so high pitched.
That's fair. Yeah.
And then you turn around, he's in the scent of a woman.
Scent of a woman.
And he's way down here like this. He says all his lines down here like this. And every now and then, he says, "Hoo-ha."
Yeah.
It's all very gravelly and very low.
Right.
And now he's like this Southern character. Like, have you seen him like on TV lately? He's like, you know, I saw him in some interview, and now he's talking like this now. You got some sort of a I declare sort of sound to his voice. He's got like a Southern accent.
It's like a foghorn leghorn kind of thing.
Italian foghorn leghorn.